Hello, this is Tierra with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated Tuesday, December 16th, 2025. We will begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined, Club Plays Santa with Bikes for Kids. Decatur Bicycle Club, Salvation Army, make delivery to Christmas care and share. This article is written by Donette Beckett. And this article takes place in Decatur. Opening this article, we have a picture of a man standing in, it appears to be a moving truck, and there are bicycles that he is holding. And this picture is captioned, Matt Ruff, Vice President of the Decatur Bicycle Club, loads bikes on a truck to be donated to the Salvation Army in the Christmas Care and Share program at the Decatur Bicycle Shop on Thursday, December 11th, 2025. This picture was taken by Joseph Ressler Photos with the Herald and Review. Holiday season. Continuing with the article. Ralph Zerwinski understands the importance of riding a bike. He and other members of the Decatur Bicycle Club helped collect nearly 60 bikes for children in the community who might not get one otherwise, but they needed help too. If you just open the door and say, anybody want a bike? You're going to be overwhelmed and you may not get people who really need the help with the bikes, he said. The Decatur Salvation Army partnered with the club to make sure the local children in need would receive the bikes. For us to give them out to the community through the Salvation Army and the Toys for Tots program is ideal because we don't have to make decisions about who deserves the bikes and who doesn't, Zerwinski said. Lila Ray, Decatur Salvation Army Director of Social Services, arrived with a large box truck to transport the bikes to the Christmas Care and Share Toy Distribution Center in Decatur. In the past several years since the agency began accepting the donations, the number of bikes has averaged approximately 35. So this is a lot, she said about this year's donation of nearly 60. That's an awesome number. A few of the bikes will remain at the Salvation Army headquarters for families who miss the toy distribution days, Ray said. So that some of the parents will have the same opportunities, she added. The bicycles were collected through donations and trade-ins at the local bicycle stores. We had 64, but five of them were unrepairable, said Scott Magruder, owner of the Decatur Bicycle Shop on Pershing Road. Repairs also included cleaning and changing the tires, and a few other little things here and there, Magruder said, nothing we couldn't handle. Bicycle Club members raised the funds for repairs, parts, and a few new bikes through their annual Amish Country Bicycle Tour fundraising ride in Arthur. They also reached out to the community asking for bike donations. Although the club has been donating to the Salvation Army for about 5 years, the members have also provided bikes to adults in the community through similar programs and organizations. But this became more of a mass movement, Zerwinski said. Members of the bicycle club encourage riding a bike whenever they can. However, they have a natural love for the activity. What happens is you go out, you get your heart rate up, you're exercising, your endorphins kick in, said Matt Ruff, club vice president. You're just having fun. All of the holidays will end soon. The love of riding and encouragement does not. The bike club, as well as a Decatur bicycle shop, will be accepting donated bikes throughout the year. Last year, we had 6 or 8 dropped off the very next week, Magruder said. They stayed here all year. Contact Donette Beckett at 217-421-6983. Follow her on Twitter at Donette B as in boy HR. Our next article on the front page of the Decatur Herald and Review is titled Director Tariffs Crushing Farmers. Costello, $12 billion in aid less than in Trump's first administration. This article is written by Peter Hancock with the Capital News, Illinois. This article takes place in Springfield. The Trump administration announced this week that it would make $12 billion available in the form of one-time payments to U.S. farmers to help weather what it calls temporary trade market disruptions in the wake of ongoing tariff disputes with America's trading partners. But Jerry Costello II, director of the Illinois Department of Agriculture, said this week the latest aid package is less than half the size of the one offered in response to trade disputes during Trump's first administration. He said the money being offered now is not nearly enough to make up for the losses farmers are suffering. "Tariffs are crushing farmers again," Costello said in a statement. "Financial losses are worse this time around, yet the aid package is 50% smaller. We're seeing repeated devastation with greater losses than Trump won. It defies logic." Payment details. The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced the Farmer Bridge Assistance Program Monday. It said the funds are authorized under the Commodity Credit Corporation Charter Act and will be administered through the Federal Farm Service Agency, which also administers most other farm credit, subsidy, and conservation programs. Of the $12 billion being made available, USDA said $11 billion will be earmarked for farmers who produce row crops. Those include corn and soybeans, the two biggest crops in Illinois, as well as barley, cotton, oats, peanuts, sorghum, wheat, and several other crops. The remaining $1 billion is being reserved for other crops, including sugar and specialty crops, although details of those payments are still being developed. The payments will be based on the number of acres of eligible crops each farmer planted, as reported to FSA, as well as statistical models that use production cost estimates, average yields, and market prices to estimate each farmer's losses. USDA said eligible farmers should make sure their 2025 acreage is reported to FSA by 5 p.m. Eastern Time Friday, December 19th. Eligible farmers can expect payments to be released by February 28, 2026. Here we break for a picture that is included with the article. There is one man standing at the podium and two people behind. The picture is captioned, "Jerry Costello II, Director of the Illinois Department of Agriculture, speaks at a Christian County farm alongside Governor J.B. Pritzker left and Cameron Joost, Assistant Director of the Illinois Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity. The group discussed the impact of tariffs on Illinois farmers in an October 2025 visit. This picture was taken by Jerry Nowicki with the Capital News Illinois. Continuing with our article. Sufficiency of payments. In its statement Monday, USDA said the program would use a uniform formula to cover a portion of the model losses farmers incurred during the 2025 crop year, but it did not say how large of a portion those payments would cover. Costello, however, said the limited size of the program ensures it will not be enough to cover all the losses farmers have suffered as a result of the trade disputes. "It's a much, much smaller relief package than last time, and this is a much larger problem than what we experienced during the first Trump administration and the first Trump tariffs," he said in an interview with Capital News Illinois. In 2017, Costello noted the Trump administration imposed significant tariffs on various goods coming into the United States from China. That prompted China to impose retaliatory tariffs on a number of U.S. exports, including soybeans and other agricultural products. "Illinois is the nation's leading producer of soybeans," he said, "and China was the biggest export market for that crop. In 2017, tariffs are put in place. In 2018 and 2019, there's an estimated loss of over $27 billion in the agricultural space," Costello said. "What's interesting about that is about 72% of that literally was specific to soybeans, and about 95% of that was specific to China. So at that point in time, again, first Trump administration, the aid package was $23.1 billion. Costello also noted that nearly a third of the agricultural losses at that time were concentrated in just three states, Iowa, Illinois, and Kansas. This time around, Costello said, the global trade disputes extend beyond just China, and in the agricultural sector, they involve many more crops than corn and soybeans. But the aid package is only half the size as the one in the first Trump administration. Long-term costs. Costello said the trade wars have affected the farm economy on at least two fronts: lower prices due to shrinking export markets, and higher production costs because of tariffs imposed on imported goods such as fertilizers, tractors, and other kinds of farm equipment. During the first Trump administration, he said, Illinois' sale of soybeans to China fell from $1.3 billion in 2017 to $116 million in 2018, roughly a 90% drop. By 2020, they had fallen further to just $29 million. So, I mean, those are major, major losses, he said. One result, he said, is that farmers have ended up storing their products in silos, either because the market prices are too low or there simply aren't enough buyers. So when you've got all of your storage that's being consumed, or most of your storage being consumed, a lot of farmers are forced to sell into a market that's depressed and they have nowhere to go with it, he said. So they're forced to take those losses. Meanwhile, he said, tariffs being imposed on products coming into the United States from overseas are driving up the cost for farmers to put a crop in the ground. Just this past year, because of tariffs, nitrogen tariffs are up 10%, he said. Herbicide, pesticide, insecticide are up 20%. Ag equipment up 13%. Tractors up 16%. So there are huge implications because of the tariffs on a lot of the inputs. While those factors are affecting farmers' bottom lines today, Costello said his biggest concern is that they could become long-term drags on the farm economy, making it difficult or impossible for individuals and families to earn their livelihoods by farming. Right now, we have more people farming that are over 75 than under 35, he said. It's scary because 58.6 is the average age of a farmer in the state of Illinois right now. So getting new people into agriculture, retaining the folks that have had the guts to try to come into a tough, those new folks are the most vulnerable. And those are the ones that it worries me will not be able to sustain this type of a downturn. Our next article on the front page of the Decatur Herald and Review is titled Law Enforcement. AI-powered body cams being tested in Canada. Use of facial recognition raising ethical concerns. This article is written by Matt O'Brien and Garence Burke with the Associated Press. Police body cameras equipped with artificial intelligence have been trained to detect the faces of about 7,000 people on a high-risk watch list in the Canadian city of Edmonton, a live test of whether facial recognition technology, shunned as too intrusive, could have a place in policing throughout North America. But 6 years after leading body camera maker Axon Enterprise Inc. said police use of facial recognition technology posed serious ethical concerns, the pilot project, switched on this month, is raising alarms far beyond Edmonton, the continent's northernmost city of more than 1 million people. A former chair of Axon's AI Ethics Board, which led the company to temporarily abandon facial recognition in 2019, told the Associated Press he's concerned that the Arizona-based company is moving forward without enough public debate, testing and vetting about the societal risks and privacy implications. It's essential not to use these technologies, which have very real costs and risks, unless there's some clear indication of the benefits, said former board chair Barry Friedman, now a law professor at New York University. Axon founder and CEO Rick Smith contends that the Edmonton pilot is not a product launch, but early-stage field research that will assess how the technology performs and reveal the safeguards needed to use it responsibly. The pilot is meant to help make Edmonton patrol officers safer by enabling their body-worn cameras to detect anyone who authorities classified as having a flag or caution for categories such as violent or assaultive, armed and dangerous, weapons, escape risk, and high-risk offender, said Kurt Martin, acting superintendent of the Edmonton Police Service. So far, that watch list has 6,341 people on it, Martin said. A separate watch list adds 724 people who have at least one serious criminal warrant, he said. If the pilot expands, it could have a major effect on policing around the world. Axon, a publicly traded firm best known for developing the Taser, is the dominant U.S. supplier of body cameras and has increasingly pitched them to police agencies in Canada and elsewhere. Axon last year beat its closest competitor, Chicago-based Motorola Solutions, in a bid to sell body cameras to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Motorola said in a statement that it also has the ability to integrate facial recognition technology into police body cameras, but, based on its ethical principles, has intentionally abstained from deploying this feature for proactive identification. It didn't rule out using it in the future. The government of Alberta in 2023 mandated body cameras for all police agencies in the province, including its capital city, Edmonton, describing it as a transparency measure to document police interactions, collect better evidence, and reduce timelines for resolving investigations and complaints. While many communities in the U.S. have also welcomed body cameras as an accountability tool, the prospect of real-time facial recognition identifying people in public places has been unpopular. Among the biggest concerns were studies showing that the technology was flawed, demonstrating biased results by race, gender, and age. It also didn't match faces as accurately on real-time video feeds as it did on faces posing for identification cards or police mugshots. Several U.S. states and dozens of cities have sought to curtail police use of facial recognition, though President Donald Trump's administration is now trying to block or discourage states from regulating AI. The European Union banned real-time public face scanning to police technology across the 27-nation bloc, except when used for serious crimes like kidnapping or terrorism. But in the United Kingdom, no longer part of the EU, authorities started testing the technology on London streets a decade ago and have used it to make 1,300 arrests in the past 2 years. The government is considering expanding its use across the country. Martin said about 50 officers piloting the technology won't know if the facial recognition software made a match. The outputs will be analyzed later at the station. In the future, however, it could help police detect if there's a potentially dangerous person nearby so they can call in for assistance, Martin said. That's only supposed to happen if officers have started an investigation or are responding to a call, not simply while strolling through a crowd. Axon has faced blowback for its technology deployments in the past, as in 2022, when Friedman and seven other members of Axon's AI ethics board resigned in protest over concerns about a taser-equipped drone. In the years since, Axon opted against facial recognition. CEO Smith says the company has continued controlled, lambasted research of a technology that has become significantly more accurate and is now ready for trial in the real world. But Axon acknowledged in a statement to the AP that all facial recognition systems are affected by factors like distance, lighting, and angle, which can disproportionately impact accuracy for darker-skinned individuals. Every match requires human review, Axon said, and part of its testing is also learning what training and oversight human reviewers must have to mitigate known risks. AP writer Kelvin Chan in London contributed to this report. Included with this article is a picture of a device, and the caption for this picture is, "An Axon body camera is worn by Matt Gilmore, one of the officers using Axon's Draft 1 AI software at the Oklahoma City Police Department headquarters on May 31, 2024. This picture was taken by Nick Oxford with the Associated Press. Next, we continue on page 2 of the Decatur Herald and Review with the article titled, Son Questioned About Murder of Rob Rayner, Wife. This article is written by Christopher Weber and Mike Balsamo with the Associated Press. Included with this article is a picture. It is captioned, File. Rob Rayner and Michelle Rayner arrive on the red carpet at the State Department for the Kennedy Center Honors Gala Dinner, December 2nd, 2023 in Washington. AP photo, Kevin Wolf, File. And this picture was taken by Kevin Wolf. This article takes place in Los Angeles. Rob Rayner's son, Nick Rayner, was in police custody Monday after the deaths of the director, actor, and his wife, Michelle, a law enforcement official told the Associated Press. Online jail records show Nick Rayner, 32, was booked by Los Angeles police and remained in jail on Monday. It was not immediately clear what charges he would face. The online records showed a $4 million bail had been set. The law enforcement official, who was briefed on the investigation, confirmed that he was being held but could not publicly discuss the details and spoke to AP on condition of anonymity. Representatives for Rayner's family did not immediately respond to requests for comment, and it wasn't immediately clear if Nick Rayner had an attorney who could speak on his behalf. Rob and Michelle Rayner were found dead Sunday at their home in Los Angeles, and investigators believe they suffered stab wounds, the law enforcement official said. The Los Angeles Fire Department said it responded to a medical aid request shortly after 3:30 p.m. and found a 78-year-old man and 68-year-old woman dead inside. Rayner turned 78 in March. Detectives with the Robbery Homicide Division were investigating an apparent homicide at Rayner's home, said Captain Mike Bland with the Los Angeles Police Department. Los Angeles authorities have not confirmed the identities of the people found dead at the residence in the upscale Brentwood neighborhood on the city's west side that's home to many celebrities. Rayner was long one of the most prolific directors in Hollywood, and his work included some of the most memorable movies of the 1980s and 90s, including This is Spinal Tap, A Few Good Men, When Harry Met Sally, and The Princess Bride. His role as Meathead in Norman Lear's 1970s TV classic, All in the Family, alongside Carol O'Connor's Archie Bunker, catapulted him to fame and won him 2 Emmy Awards. The son of comedy legend Carl Rayner, Rob Rayner, had been married to photographer Michelle Singer Rayner since 1989. The two met while he was directing When Harry Met Sally and had 3 children together, Nick, Jake, and Romy. Relatives of Lear, the legendary producer who died in 2023, said they were bereft by the news. Norman often referred to Rob as a son, and their close relationship was extraordinary to us and the world, said a Lear family statement. Norman would have wanted to remind us that Rob and Michelle spent every breath trying to make this country a better place, and they pursued that through their art, their activism, their philanthropy, and their love for family and friends. Messages to Rayner's representatives were not immediately returned Sunday night. Los Angeles' mayor, Karen Bass, called Rayner's death a devastating loss for the city. Rob Rayner's contributions reverberate throughout American culture and society, and he has improved countless lives through his creative work and advocacy fighting for social and economic justice, Bass said in a statement. An acclaimed actor, director, producer, writer, and engaged political activist, he always used his gifts in service of others. Rayner was previously married to actor-director Penny Marshall from 1971 to 1981. He adopted her daughter, Tracy Rayner. Carl Rayner died in 2020 at age 98, and Marshall died in 2018. Our next article on page 2 of the Herald and Review is titled, Brown Student Survived Being Shot in High School. This article is written by Jonathan Matisse with the Associated Press. This article includes a picture of two women. One is holding a candle. The picture is captioned, "People hold candles Sunday during a vigil in Providence, Rhode Island, for those injured or killed in the Saturday shooting on the campus of Brown University." This picture was taken by Stephen Sen with the Associated Press. When Brown University junior Mia Tretta's phone began buzzing with an emergency alert during finals week, she tried to convince herself it couldn't be happening again. In 2019, Tretta was shot in the abdomen during a mass shooting at Saugus High School in Santa Clarita, California. Two students were killed, and she and two others were wounded. She was 15 at the time. On Saturday, Tretta was studying in her dorm with a friend when the first message arrived, warning of an emergency at the university's engineering building. Something must have happened, she thought, but surely it couldn't be a shooting. As more alerts poured in, urging people to lock down and stay away from windows, the familiarity of the language made clear what she feared. By the end of the day, two people were dead, and nine others injured in the Providence, Rhode Island shooting that once again upended a school campus. "No one should ever have to go through one shooting, let alone two," Tretta said in a phone interview Sunday. "And as someone who was shot at my high school when I was 15 years old, I never thought that this was something I have to go through again." Tretta's experience captures a grim reality for a generation now in college. Students who grew up rehearsing lockdowns and active shooter drills only to encounter the same violence again years later on campuses that once seemed like an escape from it. In recent years, small groups of students endured multiple mass shootings at different stages of their education, including survivors of the 2018 massacre at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, who later experienced a deadly shooting at Florida State University in April. Another Brown student, Zoe Wiseman, reflected on social media about attending a middle school next door to the Parkland High School during the mass killing there. She said she was outside the middle school when the shooting happened and heard gunshots and screams, saw first responders, and then watched videos of what happened. Ben Greenberg, the son of the mayor of Louisville, Kentucky, was in biology class at his high school in 2022 when the principal pulled him out of class and two police officers escorted him to meet his mother. She told him that his father just survived an assassination attempt. "A gunman stormed into his office and opened fire, and one bullet came so close to him it ripped a hole in his sweater." Greenberg was often on edge after that, terrified violence could take his family from him at any moment, he said. When he moved to Providence to attend Brown University, he finally felt he could relax a little. Greenberg, now 20, lives directly across the street from the building where the shooting happened Saturday afternoon. He and his roommates were scared the gunman could be hiding in their house. They built a barricade at the top of the stairs with a mini fridge and a bookcase and put bottles behind it, so if someone was able to knock it over, at least the rattle of the bottles would alert them. "He talked to his parents on the phone all night, and they could hear the terror in his voice," said his father, Mayor Craig Greenberg. "The assassination attempt changed their family forever," Craig Greenberg said. "The shooting will too." The impact of gun violence goes far beyond the individuals who are wounded or killed by bullets to families, friends, entire communities. Those impacts are real. They're not physical wounds, but they are traumatic wounds, said Greenberg, a Democrat. "My hope is that eventually our nation will come together to take meaningful action, even if it's small steps at first. We have to do something." The rest of this article will be continued in our second half. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, dated Tuesday, December 16th, 2025. Please stay tuned.